Good afternoon, ladies. We're starting Parashat Yitro. Our parasha begins with a pasuk, Vayishma Yitro. And Yitro heard. And she asks, what did he hear? You see, Yitro, based on what he heard, certain events that we'll soon see, caused him to be so inspired that he accepted to convert to Judaism, and even more so, he accepted to join the Jewish people in the Midbar. You see, Yitro lived in Midian. And based on what he heard, he got so excited that he said he's going to relinquish his life in Midian, and he's going to move and begin a new life living with Am Yisrael. You also have to remember that his son-in-law was Moshe Rabbeinu, so it wasn't totally strange for Yitro to go to be with Moshe, but what did he hear is the question. So that she says he heard two things. He heard Kiryat Yamsuf u'milchemet Amalek. He heard about the splitting of the sea when the Jewish people left Egypt, and he also heard about the war that Amalek waged against us after we left Egypt. If you could imagine, just a few days after we left Egypt, we'd expect the nations to be scared of us. Most of them were. But Amalek was always the first and foremost enemy against the Jewish people. They came to attack us. So we heard about those two events. So our rabbis ask, I understand about Kiryat Yamsuf. I understand the splitting of the sea is a great inspiration. But the war of Amalek, what does that inspire Yitro to join the Jewish nation? So one of the rabbis explained that if Yitro was just interested in converting, he could have done that at home. He didn't have to go out of his way to move his whole life from Midian to live in the desert. You have to remember, the Jewish people didn't live in Israel at the time. So it was a tremendous sacrifice to go live in an empty desert. Why didn't Yitro just stay home? Okay, I'm going to be Jewish now. Finish, throw out all his idolatry. What motivated him to move? So the rabbis say that Yitro understood that it's not enough to hear about miracles, because Amalek also heard about the miracles. Amalek also heard about Kiryat Yamsuf. They also heard about the splitting of the sea. And still what happened? They still came against the Jewish nation. So hearing miracles is not enough. Yitro came to the conclusion that you have to cling to the tzaddikim of the generation. You have to get a rabbi for yourself. You have to cling to the hachamim of the generation. And therefore he said, just to hear news about miracles, look what it did to Amalek. It didn't change their nature. The only way for me to be truly changed is I have to leave and start living with Moshe Rabbeinu, with Aharon, with the great righteous people, and only then I'm guaranteed that the miracle will have a lasting effect, that it'll make a difference. There's a lesson to be learned to us, that although Baruch Hashem, we're from the good people, the righteous ladies that come to Shiurim and they come and study to listen to the tapes, etc., but it's not enough just to merely read books and to study, but one also has to be concerned that their company is with good people, that their society that they associate with is proper people, specifically religious people, hachamim, mentors, rabbis, etc., because just to hear concepts without having a connection to Torah, to a rebbetzin, to somebody that is on a high spiritual level, then it's not as strong, the connection. And that's what Yitro was worried about. Amalek also heard about Kiryat Yamsuf, but it didn't do the number. He still came against Klal Yisrael. He said, if Amalek fought the Jewish people, that's a lesson to me that I better move to live amongst the Jewish people in order that I'm constantly being reinforced and reminded by the tzaddikim of the importance of the faith and the religion. I think there's another lesson to be learned here as well. From here we might learn that two people are able to hear the same exact thing and have totally different reactions. Yitro, on one hand, heard about the miracles, and that prompted him to convert. Amalek, Canaan, Pilishtim, all the other nations of the world heard the exact same thing. We say that in Az Yashir every day. Shami'u Amim Yirgazun, Hil Ahaz Yosheve Pelashet, Az Nibhalu Alufe Edom, Elemu Av Yohaze Morad, Namogu Kol Yosheve Canaan. In the Az Yashir, we go through every single nation, analyzing and discussing their reaction. Some nations shook, some had trepidation, some had fear, but everybody heard. But nobody converted. To them, it was the news of the day, and then next. They just let it pass, and it was wasted. The greatness of Yitro was, is he heard about the great miracles, and after he heard about it, he reacted. He felt that these messages must be an obligation. They obligate a person to something. You can't just hear earth-shattering news like Kiryat Yam Suf, like the splitting of a sea where 3 million people that the day before were slaves to the most tyrannical empire in history of its time, without a formal army, without ammunition, they left and they took all the spoils of the Egyptians with them and they toppled the great Egyptian empire. Who are these people? Who is their God that did all these miracles for them? This episode demands from a person to think. And then once a person comes to the right conclusions, he has to change. Everybody heard this news. The difference is Yitro reacted to the news that he heard. And that's why Yitro's, they named the parasha after him. And that's not so easy to get a parasha named after you. But because Yitro teaches us that lesson, that it's not enough to hear things and say, wow, and ooh, and unbelievable. When a person hears miracles and sees things like that, he's forced to make a responsible move. Now, in our generation, we might not see, or hear news about Kiryat Yam Suf. We're not living in a generation that has such open miracles. Those days are over. But our rabbis tell us that God communicates to people today through different types of messages. And if a person's ear is attuned, he's able to listen and hear the messages that God sends him. And these messages can come in many ways, in many shapes, in different forms. But if his ear, I said, is sharp, he's able to hear God communicating to him and make the proper changes. For example, there was one rabbi called Rav Zushia. He was once riding on a wagon. And as he was riding, another fellow's wagon had tipped over. So he was calling out the wagon driver, please help me, my wagon tipped over, I need someone to help me to turn it upright. Rav Zushia was late for an important meeting. He told the fellow, I'm sorry, I'm late, I can't. So the fellow yelled back at him, you can if you want, but you just don't want. And then Rav Zushia started to shake his hand and said, listen to the message God is giving me. Many times in religion, I'm derelict in my responsibilities and I fool myself and say, it's too difficult, I can't. But in truth, it's because I'm indolent, because I'm lazy, and because the truth is, I don't want. This great rabbi Rav Zushia understood that sometimes a wagon driver, with his little comment about, it's not that you don't want, it's not that you can't, it's that you don't want, that can also be a message from God, and therefore he took the Musab. There was one rabbi also, he was riding on a wagon, and the wagon driver stopped, and he started to feed the horses. So the wagon driver turned to the rabbi and said, look how foolish these horses are. They think that I'm feeding them because I want to give them pleasure. They think that I'm giving them all this good food to give them, some of the enjoyments of life. But little do they know that I'm only feeding them so they can run faster, so they can work harder, and they can serve me better. The eating is not for pleasure. And then the rabbi said, what a lesson to me. He says, I forget sometimes when I sit down to eat. I think that eating in this world, food, is just to gratify my appetite. He says, I share the same mentality of a horse, and I forget that when I sit down to eat, my goal is in order to satisfy myself so I can get back to work. What work is that? Avodat Hashem, so I could learn better, so I could pray better, so I could do chesed better. On an empty stomach, you can't serve God. But I forget sometimes when I think the eating is for the pleasure. Oh, what a musar he got from a wagon driver. There was another fellow that was rabbi passing a jail, and he heard a thief that was just released from prison. The thief was talking to the guards, and the guard told him, I'm sure now you'll learn your lesson. I'm sure you won't steal again. After all, we beat you so much, that'll teach you never to steal again. And the fellow says, no, you only taught me to be more careful the next time. And maybe I'll be more luckier. And then the rabbi said to himself, from this thief, I learned a lesson that we can't be discouraged from failure. Which means if we tried something once, and we failed at it, that means maybe the next time we have to be more careful, or we have to try again, or we have to make another effort. The common denominator between all these stories, and there's hundreds of stories like this, is the rabbis understood that maybe God doesn't communicate to us directly anymore. None of us have Ruach HaKodesh, none of us are prophets, but sometimes God brings a person to us in a situation, and they say something, and what comes out of their mouth is directed exactly for the person. And therefore, if you just think, what did he tell me? Why did God make that person tell me these things? What is he trying to teach me? And then he hears the messages, and then already he's able to make changes. There was one rabbi passing a cobbler late at night who was fixing shoes. And the rabbi told him, you know, what are you doing so late at night mending the shoes? So the cobbler said, as long as there's still oil in the lantern and the light is still lit, there's still time to fix. Oh, and the rabbi started crying, and he said, oh, do you hear what he just said? As long as the light is still lit, as long as the neshama is still lighting, there's still time to fix, there's still time to make teshuvah, there's still time to repent from an ignorant cobbler. The rabbi understood that these words were given to him for a musar, and therefore we have to listen to our messages. They can come in, like I said, many ways. One time Rabbi Akiva was walking, and Rabbi Akiva saw a stone, and he saw that there was water dripping on the stone, and he saw in the spot that the water was dripping, there was a hole. And he stopped, and he said, I don't believe this. Avanim shahakumayim. That this water, these droplets of water, after the persistent knocking on the stone for how many hundreds of years, eventually bore a hole through the stone. And then he thought to himself and said, if that's what water is able to do to a hard stone, the Torah is also compared to water. Imagine what Torah will be able to do in penetrating my soft heart. If water can penetrate a hard stone, certainly Torah will be able to penetrate a heart made out of flesh. And it was that moment that caused Rabbi Akiva to make teshuvah and start to go to the yeshiva. Which means he saw a stone talking to him. He took a message, which means he was alert. When they lived life, these people, they were analyzing, they were watching things that were around them. I recently heard a story about Rabbi Gifter, Alav Hashalom, the former Rosh Yeshiva of the Telji Yeshiva. He said one night he was looking outside his window and he saw that the apartment across the street from him, the light was on very late at night. So he went to his parents. He said, well, what is going on in this apartment? Why is the light on so late? He said, oh, this is a great rabbi, Rabbi Marcus, they call him. And he's studying Torah till the wee hours of the evening, till the wee hours of the morning. He learns Torah like this every night. And the rabbi got excited. He was a young boy, Rabbi Gifter. He said, oh, is this what they're doing, studying Torah? What is this Torah business? What are they doing? How exciting is this? And from there, he got an inspiration. So sometimes you get inspired from a light bulb. Sometimes it's from a rock. But when a person lives life alert, he's able to see all these messages. And that's the greatness of Yitro. Vayishma Yitro. Yitro heard all these things and then he said, how does that translate to me? What does it mean to me? All these miracles and I heard it. Must be God wants something from me. And he made the proper reaction. God forbid sometimes God communicates to people in sickness. Lo alechem. You should all be healthy. Sometimes it's in loss of money. Sometimes it's problems with children. It's not always a pav message. Sometimes the message is difficult, but what a wasted lesson if we don't react. Millions of people heard it, and we don't know where they are today. They just remained where they were, and they did not make the proper adjustments that they should have. There's a story in the Gemara that says, we recently learned it. It says, the people of the city of Matam Mahsaya, was a city in Bavel. The Gemara says, these people were Abire Liv. They were, how do you say Abire Liv? They were stout-hearted. They had thick hearts. They were like, they were stubborn. They didn't change so fast. They were set in their ways. So the Gemara says, how do you know that? So the Gemara says, because 2 months a year, in that city called Matam Mahsaya, all the Jewish businessmen would take off for those 2 months. Actually, it was the month of Elul, right before the high holidays, and the month of Adar, the month before Pesach. They would take off, and they would all go to the yeshiva. It was like a seminar for 2 months a year, and the great rabbis of the generation would teach them Torah. They called it Yerhei Kala, it was the month of learning, and there was thousands of men sitting in the yeshiva learning. And on top of the yeshiva, a miracle happened. There was a pillar of fire that hovered over the yeshiva. That anybody that walked by the street and passed the yeshiva, you'd see a pillar of fire in the yeshiva. So the Gemara says these people in Matam Mahsaya were stout-hearted because everybody saw the glory of Torah 2 months a year and nobody converted. Now that's a person that doesn't get the message. You're supposed to ask what's going on over here. If we walk by the Miri Yeshiva and you see a pillar of fire, don't you stop for a second and you say, what's going on in this building? What are they doing in this building? We never saw a pillar of fire. They don't have pillar of fires on Harvard. They don't have pillar of fires on NYU or Wharton in Boston. What's going on in the yeshiva that all of a sudden there's a pillar of fire? What are they doing in there? What are they studying? What are these rabbis? What's this purpose? Somebody should have stopped to think, what's going on over here? But they were thick-hearted. They walked by, they said, wow, interesting, oh, amazing. Oh, look at this. They pointed, maybe. But everybody's too busy. You know, we don't have time to think. And they kept on going. The greatness of Yitro was, as he stopped, he paused. He didn't let his hectic life just let him lose this. So it would be a beracha lebatalah, so it would be a blessing in vain. Hence, Vayishma Yitro. It's interesting, I'm thinking now, when the Jewish people received the Torah, which is also in our parasha, the Jewish people said, and you know the famous saying that the Jewish people said when they received the Torah, they said, Na'aseh v'nishma. What does Na'aseh v'nishma mean? We will do, and we will listen. Which means it could be that the Jewish people were saying at that time, for the future generations, God, Na'aseh, we're going to perform the mitzvot, v'nishma, but we're also going to have our ears cleaned out so we can listen, which means we're going to be alert. We're going to be sensitive to the different messages that you send us. Na'aseh v'nishma. And hence, v'yishma Yitro and Na'aseh v'nishma come in the same parasha, teaching us the same concept. To be alert when things are taking place in the world, whether they're natural catastrophes, which we don't believe in anything natural to us. Everything is supernatural. So that tells us something. That's talking to us when different events like that happen. When we hear a tragedy around us, it says, Chas v'shalom, if somebody in a group falls ill, the entire group should be concerned. Because that's a more direct message to the friends, to the inner circle, to the people. But just to say, oh, what a shame, terrible, and then to go on living as regular, so then already this is a, like I said, a wasted message. And you don't know how many more messages you're going to get in life. You know, Borei Olam gives us some moments of inspiration in order to elevate us. But if he sees that we're deaf to these messages, what am I talking to? I'm talking to the wall. What am I giving him all these signs for? He doesn't listen anyway. So he moves on to the next person. So we have to take advantage of these signs to use them as times of elevation and spiritual growth. Further in our parasha, our Torah tells us that Yitro gave Moshe Rabbeinu some advice in how to run the nation. It's not uncommon that a father-in-law gives his son-in-law advice. This is a classic story. Yitro tells Moshe, you're doing it all wrong. You're one man. How is one man able to judge an entire nation? You have 600,000 men that have questions. Halachot, rabbi, what's the law in this case? Two people have a monetary argument. They need a rabbi to judge it. And you're the Supreme Court justice, and you're the court, and you're the jury. You have one man show. So the Jewish people would stand on line in front of Moshe Rabbeinu's tent from the morning till the night. That's it. There was one address. There was no smaller court. There was no local court. One man. So if a person had a discussion with his friend, a legal case, he gets online at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he's standing there in the midbar till 10 o'clock at night till he gets online from Moshe. He says, first of all, it's two problems here. Number one, you're wearing yourself out. You know, it's not good for your health. You're going to burn yourself out. Number two, it's not fair for the people. Moshe Yitro is saying, it's possible that two men online that are having a monetary dispute might just get fed up and say, forget it, they're not standing online anymore, and they're going to go home. And now the case is not resolved. So Yitro tells Moshe, you have to get help. At the end of the day, he advises him to take 78,600 people to help him do the job. I heard from my rabbis, Rav Chaim Brim, Alav Shalom, always used to tell us, look at the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. The day before, he did the job alone. Now, if you wanted to replace Moshe Rabbeinu or help him, you needed 78,600 people in order to do the job. A job that he was doing alone. Before Yitro came and gave him the advice, Moshe had no problem. It's like sometimes a guy has a worker in the store. This guy, he does the job of 10 people. Now we say that in exaggeration, but you never say he does the job of 78,600 people. So the rabbis, or the pasuk actually says, what are the qualifications of these 78,600 people? What do they need to have... in order to qualify to become a judge of the Jewish people. So one of the things it says is Sun'e Batza. What does Sun'e Batza mean? Oh, it says people who despise money. Now I just saw from one of the rabbis, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, he analyzes, what do you mean they hate money? Do you mean to tell me that they don't accept bribes? Obviously a judge cannot accept a bribe. Once a judge accepts a bribe, so he's tainted. So now he has no objectivity. He cannot judge a case fairly. But it doesn't say that. It says they hate money. They despise money. Now, Rav Elchanan Wasserman asks, what do you care if the guy loves money? Let's say in his personal life, the guy is in love with money and he runs after money. So long as in the courtroom he doesn't take money, what's the problem? Let him love money more than anything else. But in the courtroom he won't take money. He's good. What do you have to say Sun'e Batza for? What is despising money? So the rabbi said a very important rule, which is could be debatable in American society, but the Torah is telling us the rule as follows. What a person does in his personal life does affect his entire judgment on all aspects of life. Which means if a person has a certain leaning towards a certain desire, so we don't just say, oh, well, that's there, but doesn't affect this. Now, once a person is blinded by certain passion, that already, his whole judgment becomes skewed. It's not that you say, well, he didn't take money in it, but once a person is plagued by certain passion and desire, so his whole thinking process becomes warped, and now any decision he's going to make is being made now with a warped mind. It's being made with a bent brain because he has certain desires towards certain things. And therefore, it warps his thinking. In our society, we saw many presidents that in their personal life committed terrible sins, whether it was passion or desires, and the country made us believe that what they do in their private life has no bearings on what they do on the public life, which is you could be a good leader, Even though in your private life you're involved in all sorts of things, but bottom line, if you're a good administrator, if you know how to manage, so one thing has nothing to do with the other. Here the Torah is coming to tell us the opposite, on the contrary, that what a person does in his personal life, and his personal weaknesses, and his personal tendencies, if a person has a tremendous desire of money, so that affects his thinking. And therefore now, he can never be objective, even if he doesn't take a dollar. But when he's sitting in the courtroom, because he has that bias, so now already his brain is not capable to make an objective ruling. Our Torah clearly is telling us that what a person does in his personal life definitely affects his public life. We do not split it and say, you know, at home he's this, but you know, but he's a good president. On the contrary, all these things have carryover effects, and therefore they can affect the person's leadership qualities as well. Our Torah tells us that after he gives him the advice, he says, Yitro says, "Im et hadavar hazeh ta'aseh." If you listen to what I'm telling you, if you do this thing, v'sivcha Elohim, and of course if God agrees to this idea, v'yachulta amod, v'gam, you'll be able to stand, it'll be healthy for you, v'gam kol ha'am hazeh, and this entire people, al mekomo yavo b'shalom. And now it'll be good for the people as well. Everybody will reach their destination in peace. Simply it means it's beneficial for you because you're sharing the workload. It's beneficial for the people. Everybody can go to different courts. They can go home in peace, happily. But I just saw from Rav Palm, alav shalom, his quotes a Hafetz Chaim based on the Gemara. The Gemara says when a person is departing from his friend, you're supposed to depart and tell the person, Lech Leshalom. Lech Leshalom means go to peace. But you're not supposed to say Lech Beshalom. Lech Beshalom we tell to the deceased. Somebody that passes on, we say, go, not to peace, Lech Beshalom, go with peace. What's the difference? So the rabbi explains, the word shalom really comes from the Hebrew word shalem. Shalem means perfection. In this world, when a person is still alive, he's able to perfect. He's able to get better. So therefore, when one departs from his friend, he says, Lech leshalom, go to perfect yourself. Go to your perfection. Go continue your path. Go become better. But after a person is deceased, after he dies, he cannot perfect himself anymore. He is what he is. He can only go with whatever level of perfection he has. And therefore we say to the deceased, Lech b'shalom, go with your perfection. Go with what you have. So the Hafetz Chaim asks, the people that came to Moshe Rabbeinu's court, or the other judge's court, they were alive. So what does Yitro say? And after they'll have their judgment, the ish al mekomo yavo b'shalom. They will go with peace. They're still alive. It should say, Yavo leshalom. After they have the judgment, they will go to peace, meaning they'll go one level closer to perfection. So now Hafetz Chaim says a shocking idush here. He says, Bar Minan, if a person in this world stole money, or owes money because of a debt that they did not pay, whether it's a debt to the synagogue, or whether it's a personal debt, money that's owed out, that's not paid, it's possible that Borei Olam sends that neshama back down to this world in the form of Gilgul, reincarnation, in order to make sure that that debt is paid. There are so many stories about this event happening. There was once a fellow that he had a horse, and the horse worked for him for a certain amount of time, and then the horse died, and for some reason the rabbis were involved, and the Kabbalists told him that this horse actually was the reincarnation of a soul of a previous life that owed you money, and God brought him down as a horse in order to work for you, to work off the debt, and know that you have to. Now, I'm not trying to scare you that you're going to come back as a horse, chas v'shalom. Just the lesson is pay your debts. That's the lesson. The lesson is don't have any outstanding bills. So now you understand what Yitro was saying. Yitro was telling him, if you don't listen to my advice, these people might not get judgment because they're going to just say, forget it, the line is too long, they're going to go, and one guy's going to go, he's going to owe money. And because they didn't go to the court, so now there's still outstanding pledges. And then we're going to go up to Shamayim after 120 years, they're going to have to come down again. And therefore, Yitro was saying, now that there's a court system, Begam kol ha'am hazeh al mekomo yavo b'shalom, meaning after 120, when they go with peace, when they go to the final resting place, b'shalom, then already it'll be b'shalom, it'll be with peace, because they're not going to have to come down again. That's why it's proper on minor loans that are insignificant. Somebody says, can I borrow a dollar? You know, they're in front of the shul, and they need a dollar for the valet, or whatever it is. In your mind, you're just supposed to say, I'm not lending, I'm taking it. I'm giving it. I don't want it back. Because we forget. I took a dollar from you. I owe you a quarter. $5. Small money like that, where even though the person intends to pay back, but since it's small money, we forget. We forget who we owe all these. Can I need a quarter for the meter? Can you lend me a quarter? So that you're going to pay back a quarter. We forget where these things are. That's why always when you lend people money, especially petty cash like that, in your mind, you should always say, I forgive them, which means I don't want it back, such in order that they shouldn't be held responsible. But certainly on regular monies, we have to make sure that our ledger is always clean, that there's no outstanding funds, that nobody, chas v'shalom, we should not have to come back in order to make the proper reparations. This is an important lesson also for those people. It's not really for the ladies, God bless them, but to the men, that make pledges to the community organizations. I was recently talking to some of the leaders of different organizations, and they all were bemoaning the fact of how much outstanding pledges that they have. Major money, that if this money was pledged in public, where there was fanfare and glory, thousands of dollars, and then when it comes to paying it, everybody's out to lunch, nobody's there, they forgot they pledged it, not now. It's easy to make pledges in public to receive all the kavod. But it's an obligation. You have to pay it, especially to an organization that is in need of the funding in order to do their holy work. So therefore, I know some people in our community that are so vigilant when it comes to this. If they make a pledge on Shabbat in the synagogue, Sunday morning they're in the Knesset with a check and they pay it. I know one man even that goes to such an extreme that he knows he gets an aliyah on the Shabbat of the yahrzeit of his father. He knows from before Shabbat he's getting the aliyah. And he knows how much he's going to donate. And the man comes to shul on Friday with three checks already made out. So right after Shabbat, after he makes the pledges, he goes to his kunacha, wherever he keeps the three checks, and he goes to the treasurer. You brought your checkbook to the synagogue? They tell him, where'd you get these checks? He says, no, I wrote them already from before Shabbat. I know exactly what I'm donating, so I wanted to give it. I don't want to have the neder. I don't want to have the vow, because we forget. If we don't take care of the debt right away, and we don't write it down, or we don't monitor it, so it's not on our mind. You know, the day we make the pledge, it's on our mind. And then things happen, and then we forget. And not always do we get billed. And now if the guy who's doing the billing forgets that we made the pledge, so he doesn't remind us, so it's forgotten. But meanwhile, a pledge is a pledge. We said neder. So therefore, we have to be very, very vigilant when it comes to paying back not only community money, but when it comes back to paying personal debt, we have to be just as careful. In our Torah, in this week's Perasha, we read about the Ten Commandments. But before the Ten Commandments are given, God calls a meeting. God calls for a meeting. And he says, Ko tomar lebet Yaakov v'taged ibnei Yisrael. God calls for a meeting with Bet Yaakov. Who is Bet Yaakov? The house of Jacob. Rashi says, Elu hanashim. These are the ladies. It's quite fascinating. we'd expect if God's making a meeting, a pre-Matan Torah meeting, a pre-Har Sinai meeting, who's going to be invited to such a meeting? You'd expect the Rashi Yeshivot, the Hachamim, the Sanhedrin, the leaders. And here God says, first and foremost, call Bet Yaakov, call the ladies. And the rabbis ask, what is so important that God has to address the ladies specifically, specially, firstly? What's their advantage? So some rabbis want to learn that it's based, as Rabbi Bet Levi, he says it's based on a halakha. Says if, let's say, a husband and a wife, they own a property together. There's dual ownership. And now somebody wants to purchase the property. So the halakha says, you have to go to the wife first to ask her permission. And after the wife gives permission, then you can go to the husband. Again, if the husband owns the property alone, then you don't have to ask the wife's permission at all. We're talking about it's dual ownership. Why? Why can't you go to the husband first and then the wife? Because we're concerned that if the husband says he wants to sell, maybe the lady, just because she wants to acquiesce to her husband, will say, okay, sell. But meanwhile, it's not wholeheartedly. It's not coming from the truth. So we want to get a real reaction. So we have to go to her first. Do you want to sell before her husband gives an opinion? So the same thing when it came to the receiving of the Torah. The receiving of the Torah is very demanding on the men, even more so as on the ladies. It takes a lot of time for the men to perform the 613 mitzvot. However, it's very rewarding to fulfill all the 613 mitzvot. So if God would have went to the men and said, look, you're going to have such an opportunity, the 613 mitzvot, now already the lady is going to say, okay, we accept because our husband's won. So in order to get a pure reaction, God had to say, let's call the ladies first before we get the men's opinion, in order to get a pure reaction from them. And they reacted correctly and they said, we accept, we're in. But our rabbis learned another lesson. God met them in this meeting because the job of a Jewish lady is actually to ensure that there will be a future Jewish nation that will be able to keep the Torah. And that is by giving their children the proper chinuch, giving their children the proper education. You cannot underestimate the value and importance of the lessons that Jewish women instill and imbue in their children. After all, it's the ladies that are at home. The men are in business, they're traveling. Those lessons that the children see in their parents, specifically their mother, those lessons are going to stay with the child for the rest of their life. And therefore, God makes a special meeting with the ladies. Kotoma lebet Yaakov, dear ladies, the future of Klal Yisrael is resting on your shoulders. You have to be so careful to give your children the proper education and the proper values. I saw a chidush based on this. It says, I'll try to explain this clearly to you. The Gemara writes, God forbid if somebody should murder unintentionally. It's not important to go into the details, but he has to go to a certain city, and he has to live in that city, the murderer, the unintentional murderer, and he has to live there until the Kohen Gadol dies. Once the Kohen Gadol dies, then already all these people are set free. That's the law in the Torah. So it says, the mothers of the Kohanim used to come to these cities, these Irim Miklat cities they were called, from time to time, to give gifts to the inmates. Why? Because they didn't want the inmates to pray for the Kohanim to die. Because they know once the Kohen dies, Kohen Gadol dies, he's free. So the mothers, they said, please don't pray for my children to die. Here's an apple pie we baked you for Shabbat. Here we bought you a tie, or we bought you a watch. The inmates said, what is this for? No, we want to give you a gift. Please have mercy. Don't pray Tehillim all day long that my son should die. So the rabbis ask, why did the mothers of the Kohanim, where were their wives? What, the wife of the Kohen that wants his husband to die? Chas v'shalom. Why do the mothers have to go out to bribe the inmates? Don't the Kohanim have wives? Let the wives say, please don't pray for my husband to die. So the rabbis explained based on a Gemara that says there was a lady called Kimhit. Kimhit had seven sons. all her sons grew up to become Kohanim Gedolim. She went 7 for 7. And the Gemara is so impressed. The Gemara says, from where? What's your secret? What's your magic? Mrs. Kemait, 7 children, all Kohanim Gedolim. What's the trick? What's your technique? And she says, in her case, it was modesty. She was extremely modest, so modest that it says that the walls of her house never saw her hair. And she was so covered and so, private that never did the beams of her house ever even see a hair of us being revealed. So God rewarded her because she was so modest and so private. She had 7 sons that had the zechut to be private with God. Because where does the Kohen Gadol enter the Holy of Holies? It's the most private place on the planet, where only the Kohen Gadol is able to enter only once a year, and nobody else, even angels, are not allowed to penetrate the Holy of Holies. So you see, it was her great level that instilled in her children a certain amount of fear of God, love of God, that elevated them to become Kohanim Gedolim. And that's not even a teaching of a mother. That's just a behavior of a mother. She didn't go around saying, "Don't you look how modest I am." She just lived by example, exactly. But that affected the child to become great. So the rabbis say, the Kohanim, the law said that we have to keep these inmates in Ir Miklat until the Kohen dies. What's the Kohen's fault? What does the Kohen have to die first? What did he do? So the rabbis say, because the Kohen Gadol should have prayed that nobody kills unintentionally. And because he didn't pray hard enough, he's solely responsible. Imagine that, they put the responsibility on the Kohen Gadol. He's supposed to pray for the welfare of the Jewish people. If somebody can kill unintentionally, that's because the Kohen Gadol, he didn't pray that God should save the people, save the nation from these tragedies. Oh, so the rabbi said, and if the Kohen didn't pray, if the Kohen wasn't sensitive, where did the Kohen learn not to be so extremely sensitive? He must have learned that from his mother. Because his mother must have not have made an emphasis on praying in the house for people. And his mother must have not have taught the children to pray even for things that are not his personal issues. And therefore, the mothers had to go to the Ir Miklat because they felt responsible. They said, please, our children are guilty for not praying that this didn't happen. But we're also guilty. Because if we would have instilled in them the power of prayer at a young age, so they might have also prayed. So therefore, they felt a personal responsibility. There's a Gemara in Shabbat that says, the Gemara Shabbat says that there was a lady. She was about to give birth. There was a stargazer, somebody that reads the stars. Although we're not allowed to go to them, but it seems he offered his opinion. And he said, you're going to have a child, and this child is going to grow up to be a thief. He saw in the stars, based on his mazal, he's going to have a tendency to steal. This rabbi was called Rav Nachman Bar Yitzhak. And it says his mother was so concerned that from the day he was born, he always would put a yarmulke on his head. She would always put a kippah on his head to cover his head. Why? Because the reason why the men wear a kippah on their head, stands for a kippah, really is the yarmulke is really an abbreviation of 2 words, Yare Malka. Yare Malka means fear of the king. When a person wears something on his head, he understands that there's somebody above him, that there's somebody on top of him. It puts fear of God in him. So the mother was so concerned that her child should become a thief, so she always put the kippah on him, so the child would have yirat shamayim, and she would pray. Later on, it says he was sitting with his head covering when he got older, and he was sitting under a tree, and something happened that his head covering came off, and all of a sudden some fruit came off the tree, and he was about to take it and eat it. He had a tendency to steal. And then he said, I see what my mother did. You see, that's why she kept the kippah on me all these years, in order to instill in me, and he dropped it. So you see over here the greatness of Rav Yitzhak Bar Nachman, or Rav Nachman Bar Yitzhak, was his mother's education for from when he was a young boy, putting on the sisit, making the netira chadayim, making sure that he has his kippah, making sure to take him to the yeshiva, pick him up from school, etc., give him words of encouragement. Therefore, we cannot underestimate the value of the Jewish lady. And therefore, the Torah says, Ko tova lebet Yaakov. Before the Torah was given, God had to give a pep talk to the ladies. Ladies, the whole religion is resting on your shoulders. Because the men are out. We're relying on you to bring up the future generations that to be able to become observant in Torah. And that's what Borei Olam was saying. What an honor that the ladies had to be called even before the men. And the ladies are still charged with that same mission, just as they were 3,000 years ago. If anything, their mission today is that much stronger and that much more vital because of the society that we're living in, that our children are exposed to so many negative influences outside the home and even sometimes inside the home, unfortunately. And therefore, the lady must be the neutralizer in order to neutralize all the other elements that are in the world and the children are exposed to, in order that children have proper values and have proper priorities. And Be'ezat Hashem, then when they grow up, it's the Jewish mother's lessons that she taught by example and by actual verbal teaching that that child will live with for the rest of his life. So therefore we have an important lesson, not only by the Ten Commandments, but the greater lesson to the ladies is what happened before the Ten Commandments. They were charged with the most important mission to make sure that the Jewish nation will have endurance for the future generations.